for listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Forgiving other people can be really difficult, but it can also be very healing, too. For a lot of us, there's a peace of mind that comes from forgiving someone or being forgiven for something. And there's a growing body of evidence that shows it can have direct benefits to our mental health and well-being. Our guest today pioneered this research as the first person to publish a scientific study on person-to-person forgiveness in 1989, and he remains at the forefront of the field. We want to hear your experiences with forgiveness at 800-642-1234. What big moments of forgiveness stick out to you in your life? Have you ever had to forgive someone for something they did wrong? What was that process like? Did you notice yourself feeling better afterward? And what does forgiveness really look like to you? Is it just letting someone know that you've forgiven them, or is there a little bit more to it than that? Tell us your story. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And that's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Enright holds the Aristotelian Professorship in Forgiveness Science within the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Madison. He's a licensed psychologist and co-founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Dean. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, I think we all kind of understand the general concept of forgiveness, but I'm curious, as someone who has studied this for so long, is there a precise way to define it in your work?
Yes. Just like justice or patience or kindness, historically it's considered to be what we call a moral virtue or goodness toward others. And specifically, forgiveness is toward those who have been unfair to us, sometimes deeply unjust to us. And we try to do two things, to try and get rid of the animosity or the built-up anger, which can really do a number on us as the one who's been hurt, and here's where it gets controversial, deliberately offering goodness to the one who was not good to us.
And earlier this week, you spoke at an international conference here in Madison about agape love and forgiveness. Can you talk about what this concept of agape love is and how it plays into forgiveness?
Yeah, well, agape, A-G-A-P-E, is an ancient Greek term. They still use it in Greece, but it started in ancient Greece trying to distinguish different kinds of love. And there's a love like Philadelphia. It's called philia, which is mutual friendship love. But agape has come historically to be known as the kind of love that's much harder than mutuality, where you can give to others who need help, give to others when it's hard, when it's painful, and you do it anyway for the other person's sake. And that actually is seen by many people as the absolute highest form of forgiveness, but that doesn't mean if someone looks at that and says, that's ridiculous, I couldn't possibly feel and experience and give that kind of love to someone who brutalized me, I would say, of course, because we're talking a difference between where you are right now on your path of forgiving and what the highest possibility is. And we don't want to get discouraged if we're not at the highest, especially if we haven't practiced forgiveness that much in our life.
So there's acknowledging forgiveness, and then there's, as you said, doing good for that person who might have wronged us. And that does seem like the tough part. On a practical level, what does that look like? Is it kind of sending just good vibes internally, or are there acts of service? What does it look like?
Well, it all depends on the situation. Let's say we're talking with a person who's in a partnering relationship, and the other partner is very, very abusive. For us to then, who study forgiveness and use it in psychotherapy, I'm a licensed psychologist, so forgiveness is actually part of therapy, we would never say, well, to be so good, you want to go back into that relationship. Because that's not forgiveness, that's reconciliation. And reconciliation, not being a moral virtue, means you don't have to reconcile when you forgive. So being good in a situation like that might be this. You might have a kind word about the person to others. you might donate a little money to a charity in that person's name. And here's the paradox of forgiveness that many people don't understand. The paradox, of course, being an apparent contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. As you try, even for a little bit of goodness toward that other person, the built-up resentment in your own heart starts to melt away. And so you're no longer a victim of emotional abuse that you literally could carry with you for the rest of your life. And so while it seems outrageous to say, well, to be good to someone who isn't good to me, well, you're not necessarily going to reconcile. You're not abandoning justice. You can still call 911, okay? And you're definitely not excusing what the other did, because what the other did was, is, and always will be unfair. But the heroic nature of forgiveness is you try even a little bit to be good toward that other person. And we find through our science that a lot of psychological well-being visits the one who is ready and willing and chooses to forgive without being forced into it.
Yeah, when we reach that point of forgiveness, not necessarily excusing something, but when we do forgive, what are some of those trickle-down effects that you see on our well-being in general?
Well, what we tend to do, we do randomized clinical trials where we randomize people. For example, Suzanne Friedman, who's now a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, who was at our conference, by the way, these last 2 days here in Madison, and I did a study way back when in the mid-1990s, where we randomized incest survivors to a forgiveness condition or treatment as usual as they wanted to. And all of them, for the most part, said, no, I'm not going to forgive, but I'll be part of your study. They were being kind, but Suzanne in her gentleness said, come on in anyway. And so she went through a process of forgiveness with them, an hour a week, one-on-one for over a year. And at the end of that time, it kind of shocked the scientific world. The women who came to us all clinically depressed, which does make sense, right? Something as horrific as incest, went to non-depressed status. Those who did not have the forgiveness condition stayed clinically depressed. They then went through this program with Suzanne, and after a year, they went to non-depressed status. And the original group continued being non-depressed. And it was the strongest effect for incest ever recorded in the published literature. But that's just one example among many where people who've been brutalized by life, when they willingly choose to forgive, depression can go down, anxiety can go down, post-traumatic stress can go down, toxic anger can go down. And you know what goes up? Self-esteem. People actually start liking themselves more. And see, what we find, which is sad, is when people beat you down, a lot of people believe the lie and they start not liking themselves. And so when they forgive, they kind of stand up here and said, you know, I've just done something rather amazing, rather heroic. I was able, through my pain, to give a little goodness to this other. I'm a pretty good person. And their sense of hope for the future and self-esteem rise.
We're talking with Bob Enright right now, a licensed psychologist, professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison, and a longtime scholar on forgiveness. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Patrick with us in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I'd like to share the story. I had two parents that were very brilliant, but alcoholics and very abusive to each other. And the environment we grew up in for years was very terrifying and humiliating. And I carried around a lot of anger, a lot of grief, a lot of sadness carried with it into my adulthood. So I went through a process as an adult where I had to forgive my parents. My mother died of an overdose on the due date of my first son, my first child. And I was very angry with her and very sad. And, you know, I learned that sadness was a cover-up for anger and anger was a cover-up for sadness. But I went through a process of forgiveness, and in fact, in part due to Professor Enright. And, you know, the process is a lifetime process, actually. And but when I went through a very formal process of doing that, it was actually very freeing. And it was for me. It wasn't for them. It was a process that allowed me to get more happiness. You know, I had PTSD from growing up in such a terrifying environment. And, I became happier and her spouse. I actually wrote a book about it called The Luckiest Boy in the World, and was able to move forward. I mean, it's a very important process.
Oh, Patrick, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. That's quite an incredible story. And Bob, when we are faced with a situation like Patrick was talking about, I'm thinking, where do we start with something like that? You know, where do we start that process of forgiveness? What, you know, advice do you have? What have you seen that works as a starting point?
Yeah, the starting point is to first understand what path you're on. And we usually start with a definition, like you and I, Dean, just started, where you know you've been treated unjustly. The goal is to try and get rid of the resentment. And as Patrick showed you, he was miserable inside, trying to get rid of that through this offering of a little bit of goodness as best you can today toward that other person. And you may or may not reconcile, you won't excuse, you won't abandon fairness. Do you want to go on this journey? Many people say yes, some say no. But if the person says yes, then we give people a homework assignment, and it's this: try as best you can to do no harm to the one who hurt you. And that would include dragging their reputation through the mud, as an example. And see, we're not asking for some kind of goodness at first. We're saying refrain from the negative toward this person. And that itself can be rather curative. And when people begin that, then they can put on their backpack of forgiveness and start the journey. And I like what Patrick said. He said it's a lifelong journey. And it is a pathway. It's not like some kind of technique you do, and all of a sudden you do this technique for 10 minutes and you're done. It's more like a journey that you can keep on, and you keep perfecting in it, deepening in it, and your health improves.
We're talking about The Power of Forgiveness with Bob Enright, an emotional or educational psychology professor at UW-Madison and a licensed psychologist. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about forgiveness? Have you had to seek forgiveness from someone you've wronged? Have you received forgiveness? Have you forgiven others? Was it a tough process? What good has it done you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter. We continue our talk with UW-Madison psychology professor Bob Enright. He's with us today to discuss the importance of forgiveness, a topic that he's studied for more than 30 years, forgiving ourselves, our communities, and more. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Hollis with us in Verona. Hi, Hollis.
Hi. Yes. Am I on?
You are. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. I had a mutual friend of 40 years that I did work for, and went to Acapulco, and I lent him on a second mortgage, you know, $50,000 that was supposed to be paid back in a month. He's an investor, and he never paid me back. So. For 11 years, every month, I've been paying on that note that he never paid me back on, and he's living in Florida in a gated community, living the high life. So it's really hard to get over every month I go in. I'm trying to not be angry about it, but seems though I'm 67 and still working full-time, it's rather it makes me rather angry.
Wow, Hollis, thanks for calling in and sharing that experience. And Bob, some anger, some resentment can come when those problems are going to go unresolved. What advice would you have?
Well, that is a hugely serious problem, Hollis, obviously, $50,000. And here's the, kind of some of the next steps after you do no harm. What we do is then try to, as best we can, see who this other person is in a wider lens toward this person, other than, in this case, stealing the money from you. And since you said this was a mutual friend, here would be some questions I would have for you. How has this person been hurt or misguided in his own life? What has made him stumble? Not to excuse. We're not excusing him. We're trying to see where he missed the boat somewhere with regard to this idea of justice, paying back what he owes. What happened to him so that he, in fact, has made this grave injustice? That's what we call the personal perspective. Then over time, we start seeing also, we go to what we call a global perspective, where we start asking this question, despite what he has done, does he have what we would call inherent or built-in worth as a human being? What do you see? Because you saw some friendship with him. What qualities does he have that go beyond the stealing of the $50,000? Not to excuse, but we want to see him as someone who has stolen. He's engaging in theft, but also someone who might have had a very difficult, confused life, and someone who also has a worth that we're not really focusing upon yet. And when we do that, when we do those two kind of exercises, that it's part of a pathway, and it takes months to start seeing a person more widely than what that person did to us, that's when the anger starts loosening a bit and starts going down a bit. And that's when we start seeing that we're not actually going to be living with the effects of that theft the rest of our life. Do you see the difference between what he did and the effect of it? What he did, we can never go back. We can't ask the UW to make a time machine where we go back and change that, where you don't give them the loan. But what we're left with is the effect. And when we broaden our story about who the other person is, which is part of forgiveness, that's, again, part of the paradox of forgiveness. And we see that the anger goes down to some degree, or even some compassion for how he has not lived his life well. And that's when we ask someone to stand in the pain of what happened, which, Hollis, you're doing very well. You are already, from what I can tell, engaging in a process of forgiveness, because that's the next step of standing in the pain so you don't throw it back at that other person or displacing it onto others. And that's when, again, we see more healing coming in a person's life.
Hollis,
and that takes time.
Hollis, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Maria in Madison. Hi, Maria.
In a person's life. That takes time.
Oh, Maria, I think you may have your radio on. Can you hear us?
We'll go next to Maria in Madison.
I think, Maria, we have a little bit of a messy connection with you right now. Let's go next to Saul in Delavan. Hi, Saul.
Hi, and thanks for being able to listen to the program at the same time. I was thinking, and I know you two have mentioned not excusing, and I heard the word justice, but I think it's a bigger issue about what forgiveness is not, and that it's not a free pass, that it's not a thing that diminishes guilt. And in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a thing in there I think of as the anti-resentment prayer, to pray for the people you resent to have all the things you want for yourself, which to me is almost identical to a Buddhist meditation called Metta, where you pray for everybody to be well, happy, and peaceful, including people you have difficulties with. And then there's
Gotcha. Saul, we just have about a minute or so left here. I want to get Bob back in on this. Bob, what did you think of what Saul had to say?
I think he gave us some wisdom here, because he talked about Buddhism AA, Dean, have been talking about ancient Greek philosophy and psychotherapy, and there's a thread that runs through all of these. So regardless of one's religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs, philosophical beliefs, humanism, whatever it is, materialism, realism, forgiveness is what it is across all of these. And Saul is right. We don't give up the idea of justice, but we, across all of these, forgiveness does seem to be the willing attempt to get rid of this resentment and offering goodness toward the other for the other's sake, and we're the one who benefits.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
It's been my honor. You take care, Dean.
You too. Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison. He's a licensed psychologist, co-founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. He's been studying forgiveness for over 30 years. He was with us today to share some of that research and the ways forgiveness can benefit all of us. Still time for you to share your experience with forgiveness. If you've forgiven someone, if it's taken time, tell us about the process. What made it click, and how have you felt afterwards? Has it been a positive experience? If you've sought forgiveness from someone, how have you gone about that? How's it worked? Let us know. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the January 6th committee holds another hearing tonight, looking at what former President Trump was doing during the attack on Congress. A Wisconsin political scientist will look back at what we heard and what's next for the committee. And what is a campfire without some good food? On Food Friday, we'll look at some of the easiest ways to get cooking over the fire and hear your camping recipes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, how do you tell the difference between everyday politics and true threats to democracy? We learn about a new guide to help journalists cover authoritarian actions and put them in context. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Democrats in Congress are moving forward with a plan aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. We'll talk with a healthcare policy expert about what it would do and if it would mean real savings for you. First, journalism has had a mission of holding people in power accountable for a long time in the U.S. But one group of researchers thought that the way politics has changed in the last few decades warranted some new approaches by newsrooms. In particular, they point out that democracies shifting to authoritarian rule used to happen abruptly and clearly, not so much anymore. So they're out with a new resource for journalists about covering threats to democracy, and we're taking a look at that right now. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the job news media has been doing when it comes to covering politics? When does it feel biased to you, and when is it just correcting false statements? What do you want to see in political news coverage that you're not seeing right now? More context, information, different perspectives? And have you changed where you get your news for one reason or another? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Dresden is a policy advocate at the nonpartisan, nonprofit organization Protect Democracy. She previously served on the faculty and was associate director of the Democracy and Governance Program at Georgetown University. The new resource from Protect Democracy is called The Authoritarian Playbook, A Media Guide. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the motivation behind creating this resource for journalists right now?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you said in the introduction, we typically think of the breakdown of democracy as coming in sort of a big headline grabbing event, you know, a military coup or something where it's very clear that democracy has declined and there is now an authoritarian system in place. But that's really sort of a dated model. That's not how it works around the world anymore. And instead, what we see is that authoritarianism happens step by step with a drip, drip, drip of small changes that in the aggregate, when you take a step back, you sort of wake up one day and say, oh, my gosh, you know, what happened to our democracy? And for journalists, that's actually a really challenging process to cover. And one of the things we were getting questions from reporters and from journalists that basically said, you know, look, a lot of this stuff, it looks like normal political jockeying in a lot of ways. You know, politics is competitive. It's supposed to be in a democracy. And when people are competing, they're trying their best to get advantage, you know, within the system. But the things that are real threats to democracy are different in important ways. And so the motivation here was really just to provide a resource for journalists that was going to aggregate and summarize what the, you know, the experts say on this, the people who have spent their lives studying these processes around the world, to sort of distill it down into a resource that journalists could use to have a standard against which to measure these events in the world. So that's the motivation. That's where it came from.
Yeah, and in this media guide, you lay out the idea that journalists should be unbiased, but not necessarily neutral. Can you talk about what that means?
Absolutely. So being unbiased means not bringing personal filters or personal ideology to frame or shape the information that's being reported. And I think that that's something that's vital about the news media and how people get their information. But being unbiased does not mean refusing to draw any conclusions about what that information means, right? So being unbiased would have you present, you know, reliable, verifiable facts as they happen. But that doesn't mean that I have to say that this animal in front of me has four legs, is amphibious, moves by hopping, but that I can't call it a frog, right? Because there's a difference between a frog and a salamander. And if I refuse to say, well, this is a frog and that's a salamander, that's not being unbiased necessarily. You can call it a frog and be unbiased because according to the objective set standard that we have, this is a frog and that is a salamander.
And we're living in a time now where I think a lot of us have maybe had some frustration about supposed facts, supposed reality being debated in the political sphere and becoming a political issue, whether that be election results, whether that be public health measures. Were those some of the concerns you were hearing from journalists who were asking you about this?
I think they certainly fall into the categories. You know, I think those are areas that are clearly of concern. But there is also a question here that we hear from journalists, not just about, you know, facts versus falsity, right, but also concerns about how to understand what is happening. And that, I think, is really the core of this report, is to offer a resource, even if you have, you know, facts that we all agree are the facts, how do we understand what they mean?
Sure. And then from reading your report, it sounds like context is really important, both historical and looking around the world at what's happening with authoritarian governments.
Context is absolutely vital. You know, I think because this process is such a piecemeal step-by-step process, context really is crucial to understanding how concerned we ought to be. And I think one of the things that journalists do, and is absolutely a vital part of the role that they play in a democracy, is to provide that context to the general public.
We're talking with Jennifer Dresden right now with the nonprofit organization Protect Democracy about their new resource for journalists called the Authoritarian Playbook, a media guide about how to better cover threats to democracy. And Jen, in that guide, you lay out seven different ways that authoritarian governments can take hold in that slow drip style that you mentioned. I want to talk about a couple of those. One is politicization of independent institutions. This is something that might seem dry in a news story, maybe a little bit boring. You say these independent institutions are key when it comes to democracies and authoritarian governments. What are you seeing?
Yeah. So we're seeing this happening, or have seen this over the last number of years, happening across a number of different areas. And one of the examples where I would look at, where, as you say, it might seem dry, but it's really vital, is things like election administration. Right. We depend on elections to be run in an independent, nonpartisan, impartial way. Right. That is absolutely essential to how any democracy functions. But Protect Democracy worked with partners at States United Democracy Center and Wisconsin's own Law Forward to track all of the bills being introduced around the country in state legislatures that would politicize or criminalize or interfere with election administration. And in the first part of this year, we found that there were over 200 bills being introduced around the country that would degrade the independence and the capacity of election administrations around the country. And this should be particularly concerning to your listeners, because what we found is that in the first part of this year, Wisconsin actually led the country in the number of bills of this type that were under consideration.
And so what advice would you have for journalists, say, in Wisconsin or another state, covering perhaps a local development on that topic and kind of putting it in context of a potential threat to a healthy democracy?
Absolutely. So I think for journalists that are covering these issues, there are four steps that we would recommend. The first is to look at a particular event or development. And in the context of those sort of seven issue areas that you mentioned that we lay out in the report, first ask the question, does this action or this event, does it fit within any of these seven areas? And if it does, to then move on to three other really vital questions that we think should inform how these things are covered. So first, is this thing that's happening in the context of other actions in the playbook? And if so, to what degree is it happening? Is this an isolated one-off event? Is it something that is a really intense example of whatever it is that's happening, whether it be the number of bills that are being introduced or other issue areas? Is it happening over and over? So how much is this happening and what is the context? And then the next question to ask is, how much does this deviate from precedent, right? Our democracy is not perfect, certainly. There are aspects of our democracy that have always needed improvement. But knowing whether this is something new and dangerous requires understanding what that historical context means. And then the fourth question to ask, and I think that this is really vital, is to look at whether this action presents a systemic risk to democracy. And what I mean by that is not just to look at whether there's sort of one bad actor or one loose cannon doing something that's problematic, but rather to look at the way that others in our political space are responding. Because if we see that institutions are facilitating or accelerating the problematic behavior, if we see that political parties are not constraining their members or things like that, that goes from one bad apple to a broader problem of our system. And that's when we really ought to be getting concerned, because that means that the sort of self-correction aspects of our system that we have, the checks and balances, that those are not functioning right. And that's when we really ought to be concerned.
I want to go to the phones now. We have Joseph with us in Green Bay. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. Yeah, so originally I was just calling to say, I think you had some question about whether or not you've changed news sources and what kind of news sources you use. I'm a pretty public news person, NPR, WPR, I am in Wisconsin, and then PBS, WPBS. But also I try to look just at general, every once in a while I'll Google, you know, as far as like news bias and look at the major, you know, typically I find like Politico and The Hill are kind of one center right, one center left, and I try to read things from there so that I get kind of a rounded way that people are spinning a certain issue one way or the other. Although since then, the conversation you guys have been having is pretty interesting. I feel like it's been a good 30, 40 years since some of those bad apples have started kind of infecting the rest of the apples in American democracy. And you know, I think right now we're ranked like number 26 or 27th in the world as far as functioning democracies. This falsehood that we are the best country in the world and anywhere else your vote is nil, and It's been a long time since that's been the truth.
Joseph, thanks for the call. Jennifer, what do you think of what Joseph had to say about putting together a media diet and how the media as a whole is doing on covering this stuff?
Yeah, well, I think that looking at a range of credible sources is always a great idea. I think that more information for voters when they're looking, again, at credible sources is a great choice. Overall with this, you know, I think what we're seeing is that a lot of journalists are doing a really, just really tremendous work in covering these issues and in covering these challenges. I think that there's been a real acceleration in the rate at which reporters and editors are being very deliberate in how they think about these issues and how they think about some of the things we write about in the report. And so the report is not intended to suggest that there isn't good work being done here or that there isn't good coverage out there. There really is. But one of the things that I think is worth flagging is that for reporters, this is really challenging. Right? And they're working under very real constraints of deadlines and word counts, and you know, there's only so much they can do. And so the report is really intended to be a resource for them to help just make it a little bit easier for them to do the work that, you know, they really want to do well.
We're talking with Jennifer Dresden right now, policy advocate for the nonprofit Protect Democracy, looking at how journalists can be unbiased but not necessarily neutral in their work covering politics and a healthy democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in your political coverage that you're not getting right now? Do you think journalists are not being neutral enough, or are they being too neutral? Do you want to see a little more teeth, a little more information, context in your news reporting? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Jennifer Dresden from the nonprofit group Protect Democracy about their new guide for journalists, an authoritarian playbook, a media guide. And Jennifer, we were talking about some of the aspects of authoritarianism that you lay out in that guide. They include things like quashing of dissent, corrupting of elections, stoking of violence, another, aggrandizing executive power. And with that last one in mind, I want to listen to a clip from 2019 of former President Donald Trump talking outside the White House about his use of acting cabinet members. Here's a listen.
Well, I'm in no hurry. I have acting, and my actings are doing really great. David is doing great at Interior. Mick Mulvaney is doing great as chief of staff. But I sort of like acting. Gives me more flexibility. Do you understand that? I like acting. So we have a few that are acting. We have a great, great cabinet.
That's former President Trump there with plenty of Marine One in the background talking about acting secretaries versus confirmed ones. What are you hearing in that clip, Jennifer?
So this is an example of where something that has a place and has a role in our democracy gets turned into something that is really problematic. Right. We have laws that provide for a limited space for acting secretaries, acting appointees, as stopgaps when there is some reason that the constitutional requirement that the Senate advise and consent on these appointments be fulfilled, right? The Senate's not in session or there's some other situation, but it's a very limited space. And this is where context and precedent that I talked about before really matters. By September of 2020 alone, just that window in former President Trump's administration, there were 15 appointed officials who were in direct violation of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, who are holding their positions contrary to some very clear law on this. And what that does is it denies one part of government, the Senate, its ability to hold another part of government, the executive, accountable for things like the people who are put in place. And those procedures are there to ensure that those checks and balances are there, and that the president, for example, is not appointing officials who are loyal only to him, or who are unqualified for their positions, or who are likely to take actions that are contrary to the needs of our democracy. And so this is an example really that is quite clear, right? President Trump said in that quote, he liked the flexibility that appointed officials give him. Well, democracy is a system where no one person is supposed to have absolute flexibility. There are checks and balances. They are there for accountability. They're there for a reason. That's one of the fundamental principles of democracy.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Peter with us in Ashland. Hi, Peter.
Hello. There's a book that covers some of this stuff about that's related to Nazi Germany. But the interesting thing is it's a Milwaukee woman who at UW met a German, married him, moved to Germany in 1928, and they were opposed to the Nazis taking over and did everything they could. But that book really covers how Hitler very legally took over the government. And there's so many, as you're reading it, there's so many parallels to right now, it's scary.
Gotcha. Peter, thanks for the call. Peter, I think maybe referring to Mildred Harnack there. Jennifer, obviously, 1930s Germany, a comparison we always have to be careful with. But you also point out more recent, current examples of countries taking the slide into authoritarianism that you think journalists can keep in mind.
Absolutely. You know, we definitely always want to be careful about the comparisons that we draw. Again, one of our big points in the playbook is that context is vital. But I do think that there are a number of countries around the world that we can point to. You know, look, the United States is not unique in the challenges that we are facing. For the last 15 years, democracy around the world has been in recession, essentially. Countries all over the world have been facing these challenges. And I think that for any particular instance of what we see in the United States, there are parallels overseas. So if you look at some of the expansion of executive power and the sort of dismantling of checks and balances that you see in a place like Hungary, for example, that would be one area where we see similar dynamics at play. But you know, what we do in the report is for each element of the playbook, we look both to examples of what we see in the United States, but also elsewhere around the world. And it's not limited to one geographic region or one area. We can see parallels in Hungary, as I said, or in India, or in the Philippines. This is really a global problem that we are seeing our own American version of at home.
I think a lot of newsrooms over the past number of years have probably seen the polls showing public opinion in the press is going down. A lot of people think media is too biased. And so sometimes pointing out, stances or positions by politicians as a threat to democracy might be a little scary. What would you say to an editor, a newsroom who is worried about potentially scaring off readers by taking a little bit more of a stronger stance?
Right. So this is an area where I think what we try to do in the playbook is offer some concrete tips to journalists and to editors about how to cover these things in ways that are concrete, that are rooted in the facts, that, again, leave very little room for the introduction of bias there. So when we talk about, for example, we talked about politicizing independent institutions, right? There are ways of covering these issues that rely on experts who really can explain the history of a particular institution, or experts in election administration who can explain why it's so important that election administrators be independent, or why it's so important that law enforcement be independent of partisan politics. And so what we try to do in the report is offer concrete tips for journalists and editors to do this in a way that is grounded and that sort of, again, leaves very little room for individual bias, but makes choices about how stories are covered that, again, calls a frog a frog.
Well, Jennifer, that's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Drusden is a policy advocate at the nonprofit group Protect Democracy. We talked with her today about the guide her group put together to help journalists identify and report on threats to democracy. More to come here on Central Time. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.